You're listening to Indie Bay Radio in San Francisco. Now, on the phone with us, Carol Brulé is someone who has been active in the 9/11 truth movement for, well, essentially ever since the plane's impact on September 11th of 2001. And June 2nd through the 4th in Chicago was a 2006 was an international conference on what additionally has been learned about September 11th. And one of the organizers, Carol Brulé, is on the phone with us. Tell us, Carol, I mean, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of strange anomalies and obvious flaws to the story. Tell us some of the high points of the conference, and then, of course, we can go into details accordingly.
Okay. First, the conference, it was called 9/11 Revealing the Truth, Reclaiming the Future. And there is a website. If people go to 911truth.org, they could take a look at the program, and we will actually probably post a number of videos and transcripts from the conference on the website, because there were about 46 presenters, believe it or not. And so there's a lot of new material. So I actually organized the rally and the march that happened on Friday. We had a couple hundred people. We went to downtown Chicago. It's a lot of fun. And we marched on NBC, ABC, WGN, and the Tribune building. But I had very little sleep, so I actually missed the first day of the program because I was catching up on lack of sleep. And the conference was a strategy and educational conference. So we had multi-tracks. We had an educational track for people who weren't familiar with 9/11, who wanted to learn things. And then we had a strategy track for people who were fairly familiar with 9/11 and wanted to figure out, okay, where do we go now? What do we do? And there were over 500 people who came. And there were six different workshops sometimes happening simultaneously, so it was impossible for anyone to go to all the different events. And then we had keynote speakers on Friday night and Saturday night, which included Alex Jones. Alex Jones is a talk show host in Austin, Texas, and he's really the very first 9/11 activist, because Alex Jones in July 2001 told his audience, call up the White House, call up the Congress, tell them if they smash planes into buildings that you know who is responsible, because he saw the warning signs and he was trying to prevent 9/11 and getting people to contact Congress and thinking that, you know, if enough people were on to what was happening, that they might be able to stop it. And the other keynote speakers were Stephen Jones. And Stephen Jones is comes from Utah, Brigham Young University. He's a physics professor and a really sweet, soft-spoken guy. And he just looks at 9/11 from the physical aspects point of view, just saying the official story of the collapse of the buildings is impossible just because of the laws of physics. And he has given many lectures explaining how the official story doesn't work. And one of my friends sent him a sample of the dust from the collapse of the building. She lived across the street from the World Trade Center and was one of the survivors, and her house was just filled with dust. And he did an examination and found chemical evidence that it was thermite that was used as an explosive to bring down the buildings. So he gave a speech, and there were also a number of premieres of new films, and many of them featured Stephen Jones. And one of the anomalies was for weeks after September 11th, there were these hot spots at Ground Zero, where there was molten metal flowing, and that is a byproduct of a thermite reaction, is to have incredibly high temperatures which melt metal. And it's not something that happens from a kerosene fire, which can't even really melt steel buildings, frankly. That whole cover story of the government is just not true. One of the other speakers, too, was Kevin Ryan. And Kevin Ryan was somebody who said that the official story is wrong because this steel could not have melted because of the temperatures, that it just made no sense that the steel could have withstood the temperatures of the fire. They wouldn't have given way. And he lost his job over that and whistleblowing. And one of the other keynote speakers was Maria Heller, who has a radio internet show. She's very popular and gets a lot of guests that are rarely heard in the mainstream corporate press. And then we also had William Pepper. William Pepper is probably one of the more censored voices in the United States because he represented the King family in a case. He defended James Earl Ray, who was accused of being the murderer of Martin Luther King Jr., and Pepper defended him. And the King family won a case that showed that the government was actually complicit in the assassination of Martin Luther King. And this was a really historic case whose verdict was completely censored and never mentioned in the mainstream press. And then there was another keynote speaker. She was a whistleblower from England, Annie, and I can't remember her last name. I think it was Shaler. Or David Shaler. Anyway, she's on the program. There were two whistleblowers who were supposed to come from England, her and her partner, and he was not able to get a visa. I think he's more famous than her, and she was able to come, and she was quite eloquent and spoke about their experience with state-sponsored terrorism, particularly in Libya, and their firsthand experience of that, which led them to also become 9/11 truth activists in England. There's quite a strong 9/11 truth movement in England. And those were our main keynote speakers. And there was one other one that was great, Robert Bowman, who used to belong to the military, was very high up, a colonel, and he quit the military, I think, over a decade ago, and since then has been a very strong peace advocate, and he has also been very outspoken about 9/11, calling it basically treason, especially because he has the experience of being an interceptor pilot when he was in the military. And he is running for Congress in Florida on a 9/11 truth impeachment platform. So, and he just gave a wonderfully rousing, invigorating speech. And there was, as a sort of a bonus, there was the Ayatollah of comedy. There was a wonderful Muslim comic who spoke on the last closing night, who was a nice person to top it off, because I think one of the most powerful tools that we have is humor. And if we can laugh at these guys, then it's much easier to face them and overcome our fears. And that has been, I would say, the biggest point of resistance of the 9/11 truth movement, is that most people are afraid to even look at the subject or think about the subject or talk about the subject. But if we can laugh about it, then it makes it a lot easier for people to both to think about it, consider it, and overcome their fears and go public. I think it was interesting at the conference. I met a lot of people, some for the first time, but some who I had known via the internet, and some of them were quite famous, had large wonderful organizations, but they had not actually come out publicly to take a stance on 9/11 because they were still a little bit afraid of the stigma of that the 9/11 truth activists have of being labeled, you know, conspiracy theorists. Even the New York Times. It was not a bad article that came out yesterday. They headlined it, 500 conspiracy buffs, you know, meet in Chicago, something like that.
Well, it sounds like the lineup that you had, these are not necessarily buffs. Many of these people are engineers, they're scientists in various ways, and professionals, and that's what's most unique. I've been able to attend, I think, three of these different conferences, and the San Francisco versions, and you are dealing with people who are experienced and skilled in these, you know, air traffic controllers and engineers, and in the case of Stephen Jones, I have been fortunate enough to see there's a television program, INN News, that comes on satellite, you get it, and they played Stephen Jones's, Professor Jones's piece, and he goes into a lot of detail about this very strange liquid, molten liquid pouring out of the building, and you see these photographs of this dripping hot yellow molten liquid pouring out of, I'm not sure how high up the window was, but it looks like it was probably 20 or 30 flights up, and essentially, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 degree molten lava flowing out of the World Trade Center, and it doesn't make any sense.
Yes.
And then to describe the molten liquid that is underneath the wreckage for 2 or 3 months. It's an amazing thing. I had heard stories about the gold that was buried under there, and it crossed my mind that maybe somebody was trying to melt it down, and that was what was really going on. But it does make more sense about this thermite, because the instance of having molten steel flowing out of the building at 20 stories up is not the gold underneath the building.
Yeah.
And then in addition, I think, I'm not sure if it was Dr. Jones or another series of chemical experts who had been looking at the concrete dust that ostensibly, if a building like that falls, concrete is going to remain concrete all the way down. But if it's exposed to, when they do a building destruction, a building demolition, and they use something like thermite to destroy the building, it'll turn that concrete into something more similar to porcelain, a very hard, very brittle, very shiny, even type of structure that it's like a glass, the concrete essentially turns to a glassine type of structure, and that this is the type of dust that's all over Manhattan, and so it makes it very obvious that that something different happened on the day of that event. And what was also unique was you were able to see, there had to have been tens of thousands of cameras going that day. And so ever since that day, many, 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 many more photographs have come into the public domain. And so apparently Dr. Jones had been able to get photographs of close-ups of the building and the strange, with the molten metal flowing out. It is a photograph I had never seen before. The puffs of smoke coming out at various, directions at different times, as the building was falling, you're seeing these strange puffs of smoke coming out at floors below. And so if the building was collapsing the way it was told in the public's eye, you wouldn't have had these strange puffs of smoke.
Yeah.
And so it is pretty obvious that there were some explosions happening below. And, of course, there are the accounts of the firefighters who say, as they were running for their lives, they were saying, we heard these explosions, boom, 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 down floor after floor. And I think Peter Jennings and many of the other television broadcasters on that day were talking about the explosions as if it was a demolition.
Right, and even saying it looked like a controlled demolition.
Right, right.
And that was one of the nice things about the conference, too, is they did show a number of premieres of new films that were very good and very powerful, and I'm glad that they're out and we can start showing them locally, too.
You know, before we went on the air, we were discussing George Bush's brother, Marvin. Now, Marvin is apparently is he the youngest brother?
I'm not sure if he's the youngest, but
one of the younger. Yeah. And Marvin had a very coincidental series of contracts. He's a principal in a security company that handles security, not financial securities, but security operations for Logan Airport in Boston, Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C., and the World Trade Center buildings. Now, what are the odds that any company would have three contracts for two airports that these planes took off from and the World Trade Center? Isn't that a little odd that the president's brother would have those contracts?
Are you a coincidence theorist? I would say there's a number of very, very strange things that definitely deserve to be looked into about 9/11, and that being one of them. And then I would say the most suspicious thing is the fact that they just didn't intercept any of those planes on September 11th in violation of the most standard operating procedures.
Right.
And then the other thing is the fact that the 9/11 commissioners believe that who financed the attack is of little or no importance, and they won't follow the money trail.
Right. The put options were noticed the next day.
Yeah. Actually, one of the films that I went to a great deal of trouble to premiere in Chicago is available online. Anybody can see it, and it's at www.wkjo.com, and it's called Who Killed John O'Neill? And it's a very, very powerful 1 hour, 40-minute film, which looks at the deepest who, how, why of 9/11, I would say, of all the 9/11 films that I have seen. And it looks at really the big financial ties. You know, when the 9/11 Commission or the Securities Exchange Commission looked into who made all that money from the insider tradings, they deducted that, these folks don't have anything to do with Al-Qaeda, so therefore, it's just a coincidence. The film points out that, you know, Al-Qaeda is basically a cutout, a front, and that the people who were behind 9/11 have this other corporation called Kroll Associates, which are basically the counter-terrorist experts in the country. And it leads all the way back to AIG, which is like one of the largest insurance companies in the world. And that's, it was, you know, very high up in corporate America who were really profiting from these attacks. And the film is rather fascinating because it starts with one guy trying to figure this all out on his own, and seven personalities, and they're different aspects of himself in conversation and in dialogue as he creates this huge diagram on the wall with John O'Neill at the center and all the links, all the different entities who played a role in 9/11 connected to the events and the CIA and the ISI, et cetera.
Well, tell us again.
Did you ever see any of those? I think they're Lombardi prints, or there was an artist who created like charts connecting.
Oh, I have seen those. Yeah, he had a very unique.
Lombardi, or what was his name?
You might be right, Lombardi. I did happen to catch a couple of those at an art museum once, and I was really wishing I had a photograph because he had this fantastic way of doing a three-dimensional. Following the dots sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah. And he's very unique. His exhibit was only there for a week or so, and I'm just kicking myself for not getting down there and getting a video of it.
Yeah, because this is sort of reminiscent of that to some degree. But I think it's really fascinating, too, that one of the presenters was Jeanette McKinley, who organized the Question 9/11 and Call to Activism event at the Grand Lake Theater last February. And she's an artist, and I think artists to some degree have just a greater sensitivity to, you know, what's happening psychologically. And she said, you know, the country is going through an identity crisis right now. And I could see it in this film with this person fracturing into all these different aspects. You know, there was the paranoid person, you know, oh, the CIA is going to kill us for even thinking about this, and the skeptic and the historian and all these different facets. And I think that's that people individually and collectively are going through sort of an identity crisis as they're beginning to be exposed to a much larger picture of reality than they're used to coping with, and trying to figure out how to integrate it into their lives and maintain their balance and do the right thing. Because it is a rather frightening, scary thing to think that the government, who is supposed to be serving us, is actually quite capable of attacking and harming us. And that how do we change the situation? How do we rein in a government that is completely out of control and has gone so criminal? What do we do in a situation like this? Do we forget about it, stick our head in the sand, panic, or do we become active and engaged and change the direction of our country?
Well, you know, Carol, there's been some discussion for months and even years about the various press and why they do and don't get involved in many of the 9/11 issues. And frankly, from my training in journalism and in the arts and sciences, many people are not skilled. They may be skilled in economics, but they're not skilled in engineering, and they're not skilled in aeronautics, and they're not skilled in flight control, and they're not skilled in corporate intrigue, and they're not skilled in, and so every different reporter may be able to look at one puzzle piece, but their ability to not complete the picture, because they really don't feel like they're qualified,
yeah,
and so they don't take an active role in going further with it. And so I think one of the ways in which the Bush administration has been able to get away with this. So I'm wondering, one of the things that's most useful about these conferences is this kind of slow, methodical way in which these conferences come up every 6 months, and they gather together the experts, some of whom have been there before, and they come back and lay out what else they've learned in the last 6 months. So why don't you lay out, say for example, if we've got about 10 different big pieces to this. One is what happened with the planes. You know, these were the world's biggest air traffic corridor in all of the world, between Boston and Washington, D.C. That was the busiest air traffic corridor in the world. And to have four planes get hijacked within an hour and a half of each other, and nobody notice until they slam into buildings.
Yeah, that is so completely unbelievable. And the government's story on this, they've changed it three different times. And
it's still unexplainable.
And it's still unacceptable, and it's still unbelievable. So that, I think, is really their Achilles heel, as well as the fact that
then the structure.
Every time we've discovered there was not one, not two, not three, not four, but I think up to 10 different war games being played on September 11th.
Right.
And, you know, this is this is really damning information that, of course, didn't come out with the 9/11 Commission report. I think one of the latest one was the global game that was being operated out of Offutt Air Force Base, which is where Bush went to in the afternoon of September 11th. And there was a charity ball going on there at 7:30 in the morning, organized by Warren Buffett, you know, one of the world's richest men, which is just a highly bizarre, strange thing. And the person who was supposed to be running the exercise was schmoozing with all the folks, including CEOs from the World Trade Center. Now, these kind of things, the fact that CNN didn't have anyone in their headquarters, they didn't lose a person in the World Trade Center that day, is also, I'd say, somewhat suspicious. Because, you know, I think they were on the floors above the 95th floor in the North Tower. I'm not sure exactly which tower they were in, but I know that they conveniently were not there. That there's a lot of research that still has to be done following up on who was in the building, who was not in the building, who had foreknowledge and who didn't have foreknowledge. As I said, just before the conference, I was contacted by a whistleblower. He was on his way to a meeting on the 95th floor on September 11th. He was late, so he's still alive today. But the company there, the person who had called the meeting, was actually not in the building. He survived, and he felt that there was some real
intrigue,
strange things going on in that building, including a lot of fraud, and that those people are, you know, it was murder, basically.
Sure. Well, as we were looking at it in a methodical way, we have the air traffic control aspect, we have the architectural aspect, we would have the military stand down aspect, you could have the financial aspect,
right.
who financed it. You would then have the aspect of who the terrorists were ostensibly, how they were able to get on board. You could look at the aspect of who wasn't in the building. You could also look at it from who was in the building.
Right. And who covered it up? And looking also at who wrote up all these documents on saying we need a catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor in order to have the military transformation that we greatly desire to dominate the world aspect. And then just look at who makes all the money from the reorganization of the military and the burgeoning surveillance industry, because now next to war, surveillance is the big thing. It's even bigger outside of the United States than it is within the United States,
which is
rather frightening. And this excellent film, The Who Killed John O'Neill, who looks at how the insurance companies really made out like bandits. They might have lost that's another thing, the Larry Silverstein aspect here. All of a sudden, the buildings change hands just a few weeks before the attack, and this guy makes how many billions of dollars on it? It's just highly suspicious. And then for him to say on National Public Radio, oh, there was such a tremendous loss of life, we decided to pull it, which is a demolition term. And I actually met somebody at the conference who had, through the Freedom of Information Act, had tried to follow up and get documentation about the fire department's decision to pull the building, if there was a decision, or to ask if there were permits to destroy a building, to demolish a building, and trying to find, you know, the truth about those statements that Larry Silverstein said. He gave me some papers. But that is one of the great things about these conferences, is that there are all these different aspects, and often people take it upon themselves to go and find out more on various aspects and bring their pieces to the table. So I think it deepens our collective understanding of what happens, and it's just really a gift when people can share this. That's one of the beauties of the website Cooperative Research, and Paul Thompson's amazing timeline is just, you know, putting all the dots together. As you said, there are some really good journalists, and they do get, you know, certain aspects. They get really important information. But unless we could put them together so that they're in context, they don't necessarily do us that much good if they're just remote little pieces scattered all over the place. They have to be put together in a way that helps explain the story and see the larger picture.
Well, right, and that's what I was getting to. There are so many reporters that really don't feel qualified to talk about or to study X, Y, or Z, but if they are able to at least connect a couple of different pieces, they can then pass that information on to other reporters that are working on other pieces.
Yeah, so there's one other aspect, too, and that was the absolute failure of the chain of command on 9/11, like who was in charge on 9/11. Newsweek did a couple of good stories, but I think that's one that the mainstream has really missed significantly. In fact, that's one that I tried to break before the election, using Mike Rupert's book, which looks at the war games and also Cheney in the bunker of the presidential operating emergency center below the White House on September 11th, and Norman Mineta's testimony that a guy came in, a plane's 50 miles out, do the orders still stand? A plane is 30 miles out, do the orders still stand? A plane is 10 miles out, do the orders still stand? And Cheney always saying, yeah, the orders still stand. Yeah, have I told you anything different? This all happened before the Pentagon was hit. And I think it really shows that Cheney was the one issuing orders. Cheney knew what was going on. And so the orders were definitely not to shoot down or intercept any planes, until after the Pentagon was hit. So that was, you know, the decision that was made at the time. There's also another book that I got called Bullshit or something like that. Bullshit. I think that's it. Bullshit.
You can say that on the air.
Which by Ron Shallow, and it's just a look at the leadership myth of 9/11 that the government is trying to sell, and it's a damning, very humorous attack upon what the official story is, but it pretends that the official narrative of 9/11 is true. I communicated with a guy, and he actually believes it was an inside job, but he, in order to get people to read the book and pull them in, he just used humor and he went along with the official story. But even with the official story, it doesn't hold up to the actions of, it still doesn't make any sense to the actual actions and the things that they have said since 9/11, the absolute failure of the chain of command on 9/11 of Bush and the entire hierarchy, Rumsfeld not being found when on June 1st his office received the or changed the orders, the regular procedures for hijackings, instead of just automatically intercepting hijacked planes, it said you have to get permission from the Secretary of Defense, of the Department of Defense, if you want to intercept the planes. And I think the only reason they did this was because they were having these hijacking drills. And there was a hijacking drill on September 11th. So that's probably why they threw that in there, and they probably explained it to people. Okay, well, we're going to have these hijacking drills, so you better be damn sure that it's not just a drill if you're going to be intercepting planes. And that's why we've added this new rule to the books. And so Rumsfeld, of course, was out of the loop. Out of range on September 11th, and also General Winfield, who was the head of the military command center on September 11th. On September 10th, he asked this guy, Captain Leedig, who finally had the authority to, or he had been he'd had enough training so that he could stand watch at the National Military Command Center, although he had never done it before. But so General Montague Winfield says, oh, can you stand watch for me from 8:30 till 10:30 on September 11th? So this is after the first plane is hijacked. Old Winfield takes off and lets the rookie, Liedig, stand his watch from 8:30 till 10:30, which is at the height of the entire drama. They have this new character. And then, of course, Ben Sliney, it's his first day on the job at the FAA. How, you know, this is such an extraordinary coincidence, just like Marvin Bush being the head of security, that all these, you know, little things should happen on September 11th. The historical first, boom, 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 all in a row. So that nothing happened the way it should have happened, or was it that way by design? I mean, it certainly looks highly, highly suspicious. But you have to have all those little dots put together to see how bizarre that day really was.
Well, that said, again, these conferences are really useful because they do lay out different plateaus so that. If professors now agree that there is something very wrong with the architectural dropping of those buildings, then that part of the story can come into the public domain, that reporters can feel confident about discussing that part of it.
Yeah.
with confidence, that the discussion of what happened with the stand downs or why did the military not intercept, that can be discussed with a certain amount of confidence, and you wouldn't be called a conspiracy theorist simply because there would be common agreement. So let's look at a couple of the different I'm kind of intrigued. I've kept track of Dr. Pepper, or it's not Dr. Pepper, he's an attorney, right?
He's a lawyer.
Yeah, and tell me, what was his discussion in this? He's the attorney for the King family, most notably, and what has he been doing with the investigation?
Actually, I missed his talk. it was one of the ones that I missed. So I can't tell you that.
Okay, well, let's see. How about, did you catch Colonel Bowman?
Oh, yeah. He just gave the classic Bowman speech, which was extremely damning of the government's behavior and pointing out that it basically was treason and that we had to stop them. And also, he is running for Congress, so he put himself forward as a great alternative to the incumbent to challenge the status quo.
Well, he as a former interceptor pilot, I would take it then that he knows specifically about. I'm wondering about what sort of a plateau he could have gotten the conference to. Would he have? For example, I think I had heard Mike Rupert's discussing the stand-down operations. It could have been him or maybe Alex Jones as well. There have been discussion on the day. There were a number.
Yeah, he went into that. And actually, if you see Barry Zwicker's The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw, it has a much lengthier presentation by Colonel Robert Bowman in that. And he gave actually a shorter version this time. And because everybody knows that stuff already, he didn't go into a tremendous amount of detail other than to say that as a former intercept pilot, he knows the procedures. So he knows that there must have been stand down orders or worse, to prevent the pilots from actually intercepting the planes. I also, in the process of organizing this conference, got a call from an air traffic controller. Well, actually, he's not an air traffic controller. He works in security for the airport in Los Angeles. But on September 11th, he was on the radio and hearing the conversation that was going on, and people were so outraged that the planes were not intercepted. And they heard over the radio that NORAD was asked to stand down and that the orders came from the highest levels of the White House. That's what he heard on the radio. He's somebody you might want to interview sometime, too. I'll give you his contact info if you want.
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, that's what we're looking for, are various plateaus so that the various reporters and media can take the portions that they feel confident in discussing. Because it really makes sense that this thing is so very complicated that it's pretty much impossible for the average person to look at it with confidence. If the average person doesn't know much about flight, ground control and flight operations of airlines and the world's biggest and busiest air traffic corridor, and then how the military interacts with with that corridor, how commerce
and if they're not familiar with Operation Northwoods, which is well documented, that the Joint Chief of Staff came up with this idea of sending up drones with aliases and painting them to resemble an airliner and shooting them down and pretending it was a terrorist attack caused by Cuba in order to get American support for a war against Cuba. And that's very well documented, but not that many people know about it.
Well, luckily enough, the American public has become aware that there are any number of different wars that the United States has gotten involved in, all the way back to the Spanish-American the sinking of the Maine, World War I with the Lusitania being sunk, in World War II, Pearl Harbor. It's kind of interesting. Some people try to pin it on Roosevelt, but actually some people try to pin it on J. Edgar Hoover. I read a book once by a spy, a Hungarian spy who was a double agent for the British and the Nazis, and he warned J. Edgar Hoover. He specifically got the date that Pearl Harbor was going to be hit. He warned J. Edgar Hoover, and Hoover did absolutely nothing with it. He warned Hoover about 3 months in advance, and they specifically knew 3 months in advance because it required having a certain amount of materiel, and I think it involved weather conditions as well, and it also involved a certain amount of financial that the Japanese needed to convey a certain amount of financial instruments, and they needed a certain amount of time to do it. And so he was able to pinpoint it down to a specific week and day. And J. Edgar Hoover not only did absolutely nothing with it, but he made sure that I believe the fellow's name is Dusko, he was actually put on the sidelines and kept kind of boxed in by the FBI agents while he was in New York. And when Pearl Harbor happened, he knew that J. Edgar Hoover was intimately involved in the actions of it. It's kind of an interesting book. I think it's called Spy Counter Spy. But he, Dusko actually implies that, that Roosevelt, even though there was a, Roosevelt was eager to get the United States involved in fighting Hitler, didn't know the specifics of what was, planned for Pearl Harbor. But, that said, just back to this, there are any number of the Gulf of Tonkin, the Korean War was started on a fraud.
Also, Gulf War One, the whole story about the babies being thrown out the incubators. That was
April
Glaspie, $15 million Hilla Knowlton PR stunt with the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, a total fabrication.
That's right.
And the Bushes have never been held accountable for that. That has not become common knowledge, even though it was exposed by the CBC and in Canada.
Yeah, the American public, though, is aware that a great many U.S. wars have been started or concocted with fraudulent evidence. And so I don't think it's that much of a stretch to think that this 9/11 was. And in fact, on the very day 9/11, there were three very significant legal impacts coming against the Bush administration, each of which, and this is significant because, as you were mentioning, you were involved in an economic conference, and these were showing evidence that Bush collusion in a whole lot of financial crimes. And so specifically, at noon on September 11th, the commission that was put together with the New York Times, the Associated Press, and the Washington Post, I believe, to study what happened in Florida election of 2000, that information was due at noon, and of course the planes first hit at 8:45 in the morning. Then also there were Enron documents that were being required. There was a court injunction that was mandating that Enron documents get released. The Enron was trying to appeal and deny those documents to the courts, and they were being stymied because Enron was being seen as too criminal. And then finally, there was a the energy policy documents were also being caught up in the courts, and there were mandates by judges to release the energy policy documents. And also, because of Enron, the various courts of appeals were denying Cheney attempts to release those documents. So essentially, Bush was on the ropes for impeachment prior to 9/11. He had nothing to lose. And, you know, you corner a badger in a corner, they will fight to the death. You corner most animals, and they'll fight all the way out. And in this case, they were boxed in by energy policy, by Enron, and by the Florida election. And so those three court documents, or two courts and the major press, were going to prove that Bush was involved in some very serious criminal behavior. And he essentially could have been gone by October. And so That said, 9/11 was a very a prescient day for having a Pearl Harbor.
Mm. I think of what Aung San Suu Kyi said, it is not power that corrupts, but fear of losing power and fear of the scourge of those who wield it. And I do think, to some degree, 9/11 was an act of fear, not only by, say, Bush and Cheney, but by a global elite who felt that they would lose power because all the global institutions were losing face and credibility. And 9/11, think of how much it set back the whole global justice movement, how it put a chill on dissent, how they used it to scare everyone out of their civil rights. With the passage of the Patriot Act, even Congress in the wake of September 11th, they were basically told one of these planes was going to get you. It was headed towards the Capitol until it crashed in Pennsylvania. And we want you to write legislation that in the event of another terrorist attack, if you all get killed, how we're going to replace you. And Congress was also attacked by the anthrax, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Those who were championing or challenging or balking at the passage of the Patriot Act got the anthrax. And the media really shut up on the anthrax as soon as it was traced back to the military labs.
That's right. Again, we've been talking with Carol Brouillet, and tell us again how people can get more involved in this and learn more.
Yeah, well, I'm at communitycurrency.org, and that has all the local events. There's also another website, 911truth.org, and that's sort of a national organizing site. And we'll have lots of footage and sound bites, et cetera, from the 9/11 Revealing the Truth, Reclaiming the Future conference, if people want to find out more from people who've done the research.
Yeah, that's great. And I'll tell you, it's great going to these websites because there are audio files. You can listen to these speeches. Some of them have videos. You can certainly you can look at them online. You don't have to spend any money if you're broke. You can certainly get involved. And what's also nice in the community currency thing, you get to see these beautiful imitation dollar bills.
Actually, that's the deceptiondollar.com website. I forgot to mention that.
Sure, yeah, and you're one of the creators of it, and we right. can certainly thank you about that. It creates the opportunity to look at a new currency that is not the old counterfeit tenner. And again, we've been talking with Carol Bruyere. She's actually one of the candidates for U.S. Congress here in California in the 14th District in Silicon Valley. And we thank you for your time, Carol.
Well, thank you, David. Great to talk to you.
Our pleasure. And you're listening to Indie Bay Radio in San Francisco.